I would like to thank the CDC for inviting me to come here, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming to this session because it shows me that you care about public health communications, which is such an important topic. The importance of clear and accurate information provided by credible sources, especially in times of stress, really can't be overstated. And so to that end, the goals of the media and of the public health community are not dissimilar. It's the job of the news media to seek out credible sources who are people like you and to explain in an accessible way what is happening, put it into context, and help people make decisions on how best to protect themselves and their families and the community. You, as public health advocates, have stories that you think the public needs to hear. You have information you want the public to know about. And I think that the media and public health community can work more efficiently and to the betterment of everyone if we know a little bit about what each other does and the constraints and opportunities. So we are going to, Glenn had asked that we keep this pretty short, and I know that what you're looking for is real practical information rather than anything high-blown. So I'm just going to give you three little bits of information here, and then we'll go to talk in more detail later. One of the things that is important to keep in mind is that reporters cover beats. We have specific areas that we focus on. And so if you want to suggest a story idea, it helps if you could take a few minutes to find out which reporter is the appropriate person to approach. It doesn't do any good, for instance, to send a press release or an email about a flu vaccine clinic to the TV reporter or to the cop reporter. When I was working at USA Today, I would receive really easily 100 emails a day, and more than half were misdirected. So another little tip is to be careful what you put in the subject lines because I would come in, open up my email, and just start hitting the delete button. Another thing to keep in mind is that just as you are really, really busy, so are our reporters. We're usually working on more than one story at a time. We have deadlines that are very tight. I mean, we would come in the morning and have a story laid upon us at, say, 10 in the morning and had to have it reported, researched, and written and to the editor by 4 or 5 that afternoon. And it could be very difficult. You could help with that by being available, by returning people's phone calls, and by being willing to talk to the media. A lot of people are very uncomfortable doing that. If you don't want to be quoted, you can just say this is on background or off the record, and then your name will not be in the paper. The reporter still may need your information as context, and you can really help in that way. Another thing is, if you don't know the answer to a question, say, I don't know. Maybe you can refer the reporter somewhere else or get back to him later. Avoid jargon whenever it's possible, and please put things in context. If you know the context, sometimes the reporter doesn't know enough, doesn't have that background, but you do. A third little thing is the question of what is news. News is something that's new, and it's timely. It's happening now. So a public awareness campaign, for instance, is as important as it might be, or a national something week, is usually not a strong enough news hook for a page one or an outside story, a section front story. It might be a germ of an inside feature story or something. But that in and of itself is not, it's not hard enough. One thing I've always said is that news is something that happens to or near an editor. And that is, that's partly true. I always noticed that whenever my editors were either pregnant or their wives were pregnant, we did a lot of stories about pregnancy and children. But really, the litmus test is whether it's something new, the significance of the story, and why it's in the paper today, why it needs to go in now. Very often, I've heard editors say, tell me why we have to run this today. Seasonal flu, for instance, which is very important, occurs every year. And so we need to find a new hook for it each time that we write about it. We can't just say it's flu season again. That's why we're always saying, is it going to be a bad flu year or a good flu year? And you scientists always say, we have no way of knowing. We don't know. Flu, you can't predict. But in any case, I think I'll leave you with all that as food for thought. And thank you so much for your attention. I look forward to hearing more about what you're interested in. Thanks.
Well, I'm Mark Aldrin, and I want to thank you very much for having me here today. It's nice to be here. It's especially nice to be here because I just spent the last 2 hours slogging through traffic trying to get through this mess that's been created by the tornadoes that passed through on Friday night and has turned downtown into a bit of a traffic nightmare. I also want to thank you for your tap dance in the beginning there that gave me a few minutes to get in here and gave me a chance to catch my breath. In live TV, we call that ad-libbing, and there's great art to it, and you do it very well, so I really do appreciate it. Among the things that I do, like Anita, I suppose, is I serve the function of an editor. And what is an editor, anyway? Well, the best definition that I think I have ever heard for editor came from Ambrose Bierce in his 1911 classic called The Devil's Dictionary. And in The Devil's Dictionary, Mr. Bierce defined editor this way. He said, the editor is the person at the newspaper whose job it is to separate the wheat from the chaff and to make sure that the chaff gets printed. I could update that a little bit today by saying to make sure that the chaff gets broadcast. And in modern day language, I would imagine that they might not be nearly so kind as to even call it chaff. I work for WGCL-TV, which is the CBS affiliate here in Atlanta. Atlanta is the eighth largest television market in the country. We have a newsroom that consists of about 90 people. And of course, that includes reporters, photographers, anchors, editors, producers, managers, just all sorts of people. And that does not include all of the support people who work in engineering and production and sales and things like that. On a typical day, there are certain things that come to play, I think, in every local television newsroom that I hope will be of some interest to you. We usually do several editorial meetings every day. We do one in the morning and one in the afternoon. We do locally produced programs here at 5 in the morning, at noon, at 4, at 4:30, at 6, at 11. So basically, it's just one deadline after another, after another, after another. We also do post-program meetings after every newscast to kind of discuss what went right and what went wrong. And there are certain, I think, dynamics that are pretty typical of every local TV newsroom that you should probably be aware of. The multiple deadlines is certainly one of them. Also the fact that, just like everybody else in society these days, we are just awash in information. We've got way more information than we can truly handle. And so in your efforts to get the word out, to get information into a newsroom that makes some kind of sense, you should be aware of that. My advice would be to keep your news advisories as simple and as to the point as possible. And you might have to make multiple efforts to do that. And I'll tell you why when we get into our question and answer session in just a few minutes. But one of the questions that seems to come up a lot is, are TV journalists truly unbiased, or are they prejudiced in some way? And I can tell you, in my 40 years in the business, for the most part, most television reporters and producers make a good faith effort to be unbiased and to be factual in their reporting, but there are certain pressures that tend to come to bear on anybody in any newsroom. And those things can't help but affect the decision-making process. Now, for television, one of those dynamics is the fact that television thrives on video. The more exciting and the more colorful the video, the more excited that they get. If there's anybody here from Los Angeles, you are aware of just how much that particular television market is addicted to car chases. You'll just see one car chase after another, after another, after another. So in television, at least, we have a definite bias toward pictures. And a lot of times in our decision-making process, we will simply say that some stories are more appropriate for print media. Also, there is more narrow casting today than ever before. When I first got into the business, we were truly broadcasting. But these days, we tend to be more narrow casting. And that means that we certainly aim a lot of our programming at specific target audiences. Sometimes those are sales-driven demographics. Sometimes they are in a particular geographic area of a television market. But what that boils down to is the fact that oftentimes reporters don't have the freedom to simply chase a good story because it's a good story. And so that becomes part of the decision-making process also. Also, in regards to that question about reporters being unbiased, one of the best answers I think I ever heard to that question came from Ari Fleischer. You'll remember he used to serve as a White House press secretary. And shortly after he retired from that job, I remember somebody asked him, you know, about all, because he deals with some of the best and the most aggressive reporters in the country up there at the White House. And they asked him that question, and he said, you know, not really. He said, most of the reporters I dealt with did not particularly have a bias when it came to a certain political philosophy or a certain political party or a certain candidate. But he said, it is true that reporters have a bias toward conflict. And having been in this business for quite a while now, I must acknowledge that that's true. Reporters look for stories that have conflict because they see that as interesting and intriguing. A couple of other quick just dynamics to keep in mind in a newsroom is that, and this is kind of relates to what Anita said earlier too, is that, frankly, things change, and they can change pretty quickly. So circumstances change, breaking news changes, target audiences change, and the configuration of the moment can change on a dime. So frankly, if you perhaps have put out some information that you feel is very important and you may have planned it for days in advance, weeks in advance, months in advance, anything can happen. If for example, we had been scheduled to cover this conference and this conference took place on Saturday, well, we wouldn't be here today because obviously, you know, we'd be spending all of our time covering the aftermath of the tornado. So that's just kind of a few of the things that play into the life of a local television newsroom. And I hope that's at least a little bit helpful. And I look forward to any of your questions and discussion. Thank you.
No, very, very good insights. And as chief of media relations at CDC, we deal with the media multiple times in the course of a day. And one of the things that struck me as they were talking was that the deadlines are short. And one of the challenges it poses for organizations like ours is that we have to be able to provide experts on a very short notice. And sometimes we don't have as many experts as we wish we had if there's a lot of calls. And many times those experts are often involved in the investigation. So it means trying to pull them out of doing something else to talk to the media. The other thing is always interesting at CDC is Fridays is casual dress day. And so when TV stations call us on Fridays and they want someone to go on camera, I'm always mindful that I have to see how they're dressed. And if they're gonna show up in a flannel shirt and blue jeans, which I've had happen to me, we're probably not gonna have them being on camera that day unless they can go home and change clothes. So lots of challenges meeting those short deadlines. I thought I'd take my prerogative here and ask them some questions based on some of my experiences both in the National Immunization Program and at CDC with people interested in trying to get media attention. I guess I'll take two kind of current examples. CDC holds a lot of conferences, and the National Immunization Conference being one of them. A month or two before these conferences, people often come to the media relations people at CDC and say, you know, we're holding the National Immunization Conference. It's going to be in Atlanta. We should get a press release out. Could you comment about, you know, if we were going to get a press release out, what would make that press release interesting? What would make you say, I want to come to that conference. Is it enough to just send a press release saying the National Immunization Conference is coming to Atlanta, it's going to take place between these dates and these dates, show up?
You can't hear me, huh? Can you? Oh, okay. I think the first question, if you sent me a press release like that or a notice, you do send media alerts saying that there is going to be a conference, then I call you or Curtis or someone and say, is there anything new being presented at the conference? Are there new data being presented? Are there topics that are timely and, you know, maybe hot topics that would be worth at USA Today, it would involve sending somebody and putting them up in a hotel and that sort of thing, and taking a reporter out of circulation for a period of time. So you would have to, there would have to be stories that would come out of it. It would have to be worth it in that way.
Absolutely. I think the same is true for television, in that if you can provide us with a current hook, some angle that's topical, something that relates to anything that's been in the news recently, that would certainly make our job a little bit easier. And too, you know, a lot of times when we get in news releases too, I can't tell you how many news releases we've had to just throw in the garbage can because they were simply too convoluted. And I know that sounds like a simple, basic thing, but it really is true that time is limited. As I said earlier, we're just awash in information. So anything that you can do to get to the point of those kind of announcements quickly, and if you can highlight some sort of an angle that we might be interested in pursuing, that greatly increases your chance of getting coverage on that particular topic.
And again, it's one of those things that may not be quite so obvious, that when a reporter comes to a conference, whether it's a local reporter, whether it's a national reporter, they're taking time out. That means that they're going to have to find stories at this conference that they won't be covering other things out there. And so for their editors and assignment editors, that's a big consideration. Another kind of current example, the last week of April is National Infant Immunization Awareness Month. And so many people are probably going to think it's a good idea to reach out to the media and let people know that National Infant Immunization Awareness Week is taking place the last week of April. Same kind of question. I mean, what would it take to get your organizations interested in a week like that for you to cover it or decide to cover it? I guess first nationally, from a national perspective, and then locally.
I can tell you that the saying that it's the week is not something that I could then, as a reporter, could say to my editor, well, it's National Infant Immunization Week, so let's do a story on that. I would have to say infant immunizations have been in the news a lot. There's controversy. We love controversy. There's misunderstanding, actually. I think that would be the most important thing, is that I could say there's been a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of conflicting information. The internet is aflame with it. Maybe now would be a good time for us to do a story about vaccine safety, the myths about vaccine, and to answer some of the kinds of questions parents have. And so we would probably, I think I could probably sell that article, to be honest with you. I could convince my editor that would be a good story for us to do. And then if there's anything going on during that week that is noteworthy, if there is going to be a conference or a teleconference or anything like that, if you could just give us as much information about it and let us give us stuff to work with, basically, is what I'm asking for. The more that I as a reporter have to work with, the better I can maybe help find the angle or the thing that will work with my editors, that will allow them to give us the space that's needed, because space is at a premium. The other thing that's at a premium is time, especially in the era of when newspapers are downsizing all over the place. All newspapers are. There are fewer reporters, fewer time for anybody to cover anything. And so it becomes, as Mark was saying, more and more important for you to help us to find the focus that's going to get the job done.
Before Mark, so it sounds like if you do that National Infant Immunization Week story, you're going to bring up some controversy, some things that people who are looking for just a positive story may not appreciate.
It may turn out to be a positive story, but you have to bring up, you can't ignore the fact that there is a significant group of, a significant fraction of people who are afraid of vaccines now, for whatever reason, mainly because they're hearing a lot of uncontested information and reading stuff on the internet. So I would think that you would leap at the chance to correct some of the misunderstandings. I know that this is a very touchy issue, and I'm very interested in it personally, actually. There's a little push-pull between whether you know, is it better not to mention that some people are afraid of vaccines, because maybe if you don't mention it, then other people won't know that there are some people afraid of vaccines, or is it better to hit it on, you know, hit it and answer those questions? I believe that information is power, and that truth can change people's minds. I sincerely hope that's true. I may be crazy, but I think that it's more important to address it head on and answer every conceivable question, even though you may have to do it over and over and over.
Anita is exactly right. I think information is power. And I acknowledged a little bit earlier, somewhat to my own chagrin here, that reporters thrive on conflict. Well, you can also look at that as an opportunity, in that because this has become a somewhat controversial subject, this is your opportunity to get the facts out there. And you, as part of the story, you will probably hear some things from the other side of that issue that you do not like and do not appreciate. But that makes it all the more important for you to get the real facts out to people who need it. And so I would look at that perhaps as a golden opportunity, actually, to draw more attention to a very important subject.
Another topic I think might be interesting to talk about is press releases. There's a lot of people who don't work in the media believe that press releases are probably the most powerful, or one of the more powerful tools to get a story in a medium. Sometimes they spend a lot of time writing those press releases. Sometimes those press releases are two and a half pages long. Sometimes those press releases go through lengthy clearance processes where people are focusing on changing verbs and words. What could you give us some insights into what happens when a press release enters your organizations, and what role they play, and if a press release is 2.5 pages long, is that helpful, not helpful? What exactly? Just take us through that process. You want to start, Mark?
In our shop, the news assignment desk sort of serves the function of the air traffic control center for the newsroom, and so the assignment desk usually should be your first stop, I think, when it comes to submitting information. Their job is, actually, it's a job that'll make you pull your hair out, and it's one of the reasons why I never particularly liked the time I spent on the news assignment desk, and that's why I moved on to another position in the newsroom. But the people on the news assignment desk not only take in all of those press releases, but they're the same people who sit there hour after hour, and they monitor the police and fire radios for breaking news, and they take all the phone calls, and they monitor what the competition is doing, and so they have this deluge of information that's coming across to them. Now, they do go through a vetting process for every news release that comes across their desk, but as Anita said, they are pressed for time. And there's an awful lot of competing factors for their attention. So our press release is important. I do think that they are important. But I somehow, even after all these years, I see people manage to screw them up. They either put way too much information and make it almost impossible for an editor to quickly find the crux of the story and get to the point, or sometimes they don't provide quite enough information, but in terms of formulating those, I mean, I would say if you can give us the highlights of what we need to know, the who, what, when, where, and why, and if you can provide some sort of an intriguing angle, something that will make it stand out from the crowd just a little bit, then if they're intrigued enough with it, they will get in touch with you and they will ask you for more information at that point. They will track you down to get the rest of it. Sometimes it is as simple as simply providing a human angle to a story. All reporters like to humanize these issues. And so if you can save the reporter or the producer a few steps by providing somebody who you know has an interesting story to tell that illustrates that point, that's a great thing.
I agree with everything that you've said. And I also have to say, though, that there is no one answer to that question, because sometimes there is a situation, you know, at USA Today, there's something called the Lifeline or Better Life column. It's a briefs column. And sometimes press releases were useful for that, for the briefs column. So we would, and in that case, we needed the whole press release because we were usually throwing that together at the last minute and didn't have time to do follow-up calls. But usually the press release was the second tier for me. The first contact would be an email or a phone call or something like that that would get my interest, and then the press release would maybe flesh that out a little bit. So the way that it's, can I take just a minute to say about this stuff? In print media, the way that it works is that the stories either are assigned to you by an editor, or as a reporter, particularly as a reporter who'd been there for a while and had a pretty well established beat. More often than not, I would tell my editor, these are things coming up that I would like to write about, and I think it's interesting. So, and then I would write what's called a budget line. Do you know that term? It would have just maybe a one paragraph summary of what I think the story will say, and it's not cast in stone. It just tells the editors what I'm thinking of for the story. Well, that you have to learn to write those budget lines to be really, you know, jazzy, because that will get. It will get you the space that you need for the story, because then my editor would take it to a meeting of editors, and he would say, Anita has such and such a story, and ooh, that sounds pretty good. Well, we'll be sure to make space for that in the paper. And then the other thing that happens, so I'm given the okay, then I start to report the story. Then there's a layout person who designs the page, and she may say, you have 90 lines for that story. Well, a 90-line story on a news page is usually one that runs right along the bottom. It's called a strip story, and it would be at the bottom or at the top. It's about that size. That's a 90-line story. A centerpiece would be just 150 lines. And in USA Today, the big story is the cover story that jumps. That's only 250 lines. So space is really tight. So I digress, but then
no,
I can
it's
go
a very
on
good
further.
Point. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'll throw one more question, and then I'll turn over to the audience to ask some questions. We find out that a TV program is going to do a story or has a plot line that isn't really favorable to vaccines. Or 2020 is going to do a story that isn't favorable to vaccines. And when that happens and people find out about it, one of the first things they think about is we should reach out to other media, other news media, and call them and let them know, I guess. What do you think of that approach, that if a new TV series is going to air next week and it's got a plot line that isn't necessarily favorable to some topic, is it a good idea for advocacy groups to pick up the phone or start doing some outreach to local TV stations, newspapers, other media to say, you know, how dare they do such a story, or they're doing such a story, we want to get our side out there? I mean, what's your thoughts about those kinds of things?
I know the one you're talking about. One thing is, I think that sometimes if you jump the gun, particularly when it's a TV show that nobody is going to watch anyway, that you might then give publicity where you don't want to give publicity. And I think that sometimes you can. I have to say I didn't see the show and I have never seen it. It might be a wonderful show, but it was a new show. It wasn't very well publicized. I heard more about it from the vaccine people than anybody. So I think that you can inadvertently give publicity where it's not warranted. If it were 60 Minutes or something like that and it were a big controversy, well, I would think that 60 Minutes would already be in touch with you, to be honest. I don't think they would just do a one-sided thing. Anyway.
I think that that's a great answer. Now, is the show you're referring to, is that Eli Stone on
yes.
ABC? Is that right? Okay, I happen to see that program too. I guess my question would be, why would you feel compelled to respond to an entertainment program, to a work of fiction?
I think actually what you're saying is that point of view being presented in a fictional drama like that normalized the idea that vaccines are related to autism. It normalized it, which is something that is of concern, I'm sure. Nothing happens.
But I guess just to kind of follow up, what kind of story would that produce? I mean, I think the story that people would like to see would be a story that takes the program and does a kind of a line for line rebuttal and says, the program says this, that's not true. The program says this, that's not true. Is that the kind of story that's likely to arise, or would it be a different kind of story that would likely arise if it piqued your interest and you decided to do a story? How likely would you be to do a story that said, here's what the program says, here's what others believe, versus doing a story on they're mad, they're not happy, let's focus on the conflict here?
You know, at USA Today, we actually stopped writing about the controversy because it was this constant, they say this, they say that, and it wasn't advancing in any way. We'd already answered all those questions, and you know, I don't think that we would have written about that TV show at all. What we might do is to try to do something that would elucidate. We might have used this recent court case, this vaccine court case, as something to try to look again at the issue of vaccine safety. Because there are questions, parents have questions, and I realize it's a moving target. It used to be that they were afraid of MMR vaccine. Then it became that they were afraid of, I think right now the issue is multiple vaccines given on the same day or something, that parents think that their children's immune systems are overwhelmed. Well, you know, there are some very good people in public health who have been answering those questions, and they can explain that. A lot of reporters who don't cover this all the time really don't know. And it seems to them, well, there's mercury in vaccines. What else is in there? I heard somebody say that there was antifreeze in vaccines. So, I mean, let's do a story that says, what is in vaccines? And how dangerous is it? And why do children get fevers from vaccines? And if they get a seizure, does that mean they're going to be autistic later? Just answer the questions. And that's what I would do. I mean, either do it as a Q&A or do it as a, you know, 10 things you need to know about vaccines or something like that, something real simple that just gets it out there.
But you're saying it'd be more likely, that kind of an article would be more likely prompted by a court case than by an entertainment TV show.
Than by a fictional TV show that is not, you know, a really big, big top Nielsen rating show. I mean, and maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, actually, it's not doing that well. I've seen it several times, and it's kind of an intriguing little show. I never regarded it as anything more than, you know, a passing fancy and a work of fiction. I'm sure some people took it a lot more seriously than that. In my shop, I can tell you that we would not feel compelled to do any sort of a line-by-line rebuttal to an entertainment program. Certainly not one that's on ABC, but even if it were on, even if it were on CBS, we would not feel an obligation to do that. Now, as you said, if it were on 60 Minutes, we would probably give it another look and give it a lot more consideration to doing. And also, if, as you say, if it takes on a life of its own in the community and it becomes an issue of controversy, at that point we might feel compelled to address it.
Exactly.
Well, you know what? Well, you're right in that there's an awful lot of misinformation out there about not just this subject, but you can get misinformation on anything, anywhere, 24 hours a day, on the internet, on YouTube, on any of those sources. And granted, those things kind of take on a life of their own. But, you know, in the real world, too, if I spent all of my time trying to shoot down every piece of misinformation that was out there in the public, that's all I'd ever do, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It is a problem, though, because the misinformation is being repeated over and over, and it's kind of viral, you know. And then you'll have the other thing that irritates me is that very often it's treated on a very superficial level. So they'll have two mothers of children who have autism who believe that their children's autism is related somehow to vaccines. And then they'll have somebody from the American AAP, whatever they call it, and somebody else. And they're on for 3 minutes and they're saying boom, 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 boom. And it doesn't advance the argument. It doesn't really... You can't really weight them the same way that you have two. You'll have two really credible scientists saying something, but then you have two very distraught parents, and it's a difficult thing. It is. I believe me. I sympathize. I do understand how difficult this is.
Well, it also sounds like that just listening to you that you don't view necessarily your role as being the arbiter of truth so much as presenting. Here's what these folks believe. Here's what these folks believe. You're not trying to come to some resolution.
But how do you know? You know, when you have scientists, two scientists, this one says this, this one says this. I was an English major. You know, it's not up to me to decide who is telling the truth, particularly when it's out there in the world and there are a lot of people who disagree. Go ahead. They pit them. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it may be time to do something like that. You know, that's probably a good point.
Yeah. Now, see, I have to disagree with you about. I think that's one of the myths of misunderstandings that people on the editorial side do anything to sell papers. I have to tell you, we are not. The newspapers are not. Newsrooms are not organized enough to have an agenda. They are really not. There is no agenda in newspapers. I think what happens is that what that reporter really meant is that I didn't really understand the depths of these controversies. I mean, when you have a scientific art, you know, but one of the problems here's something that I really wanted to say. I'm so glad I remembered it. Scientists don't speak in absolutes. You're not geared to do it. You hate absolutes. So when I, as a reporter, ask Dr. somebody, do vaccines, is the Marisol related to autism in any way? And the answer I'll get is, there is no evidence to suggest that vaccines and thimerosal, or that thimerosal or vaccines have any causal relationship to autism. Well, that sounds to me and to my readers like a dodge. If it doesn't cause autism, say it doesn't cause autism. Well, you can't do that because you're scientists, and you can't make absolute statements like that. So what needs to be done is that it's up to the reporter, I always feel, and it's up to you to explain to the reporter that scientists just can't talk like that because, I mean, even evolution is still a theory, you know. You need to explain to the reporter that that's not the way science works, and that there have been X number of hundreds of studies and not one has found any real relationship. Or don't even say real, any relationship. Because if you hedge it, it sounds like it's a dodge.
You know, I do appreciate what you're saying, and there is a certain degree of truth in it. Now, Anita and I are both journalists, so we don't come down on the side of how many papers were sold today. I personally don't sweat how many people watched the newscast last night. My bosses do. They pay an awful lot of attention to that. And that relates to what I said a little bit earlier about there are certain, you know, dynamics in a newsroom, you know, that do affect the way we do our jobs, and they point us in certain directions, et cetera. But as journalists, you know, as ethical journalists, we try to get the truth out there. We try to do the right thing. And at the end of the day, it's not all about how many people were watching or how many people were reading, at least not for us. Now, there are other things that go on in a television newsroom that, you know, this may be kind of like making sausage, you know, that where you don't really want to see it, but we have conflicts occasionally too. I cannot tell you how many times the promotion people at my television station have come up with a promo for a story, and it has come down on the sensational side, or it has come down on the side of making people fearful, you know, could this happen to you? I will tell you that I remember this is one of the silliest cases that I can think of just off the top of my head. But years ago, somebody decided that they were going to do a story on is your soda can making you sick? In other words, if you get a Coca-Cola out of the machine, you know, you pop open the can and you start to drink. And in other words, are there germs on there that are going to make you sick? Well, you know, I remember they produced a promo for that story that made it sound like your life was in jeopardy if you drank a Pepsi. And we did the story, and we found out, well, guess what? No one was getting sick from drinking sodas out of a machine. And I remember having a knockdown, drag-out fight with the people in my TV station over the accuracy of the promo because I said it was alarmist, it was misleading. But do those sort of fights go on? Yes, they do. And I would be dishonest if I told you anything different.
Well, yeah, it sounds like the folks in the who write the headlines and who do the promos may have a foot in that camp of trying to drive audiences. Got time for a few questions. I'll start over there.
I just want to, the scenario that you mentioned about having the two autistic children on camera and then the two scientists who disclaim or deny that relationship, I think the unfortunate thing there is that after that kind of interview takes place, and the denial is made, trying to reinforce scientific evidence, the general public reaction is, well, what else would you expect a government person to say? So, I mean, they just kind of discount the science-based evidence. And then that's followed by two well-known politicians coming up and saying, oh, I think there is a connection between vaccines and thimerosal and autism.
Yeah. I just will say that I used to cover Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And, you know, I don't know if you know what that is. It's a fatal disease that it's brain wasting, it's called. And it affects about one person per million everywhere in the world and always has. But there is a new variant that's caused by bovine BSE, mad cow disease. And so there was a period of time where I was covering that, and the family members of the CJD victims were positive that the government was hiding cases, not telling the truth, that there was it was really far more widespread. And they believed, they absolutely believed that their family members got CJD because of something they ate. And I think CDC even did an investigation of some racetrack restaurant in New Jersey because there were so many, people were so insistent. I think there is a bit of a, I think that this autism thing is similar in that it comes out of nowhere and parents are devastated and they don't know why it happened. And so they kind of glom on to something. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to keep going on. Go ahead.
One last question.
Kind of got a question or two questions for the panel. I understand what you're saying about journalism, probably there not being a nefarious plot, but I'd also kind of like your reactions to a couple of things. Is one, I think my experience is there's a tendency to go for the story, i.e. in the UK, Wakefield and MMR, the stories made the front page of the paper when it was bad news and sensational, but when Wakefield was completely discredited, I didn't see very much on the retraction side. And to your comment about Creutzfeldt-Jakob, I think that's a really interesting one, which is, yes, I do agree with you that parents do firmly believe this, but there's a difference between a scientist, and as you said, the scientist may be a little bit more cautious, but when you put a scientist up against Jenny McCarthy on a show, not to be flippant, I think journalism, it's disingenuous to say that's not our responsibility, because Jenny McCarthy, I don't think really is qualified to actually make those statements, maybe very believable on a TV show. So I'm wondering how does that happen?
We didn't cover Jenny McCarthy for that reason. I mean, honestly, I know a lot of people did. She had a book, she was on Oprah, it was very popular. People talk about it all the time. I agree with you. I have to agree with you. You can't, they're not equally weighted. The scientists are not, the scientists are much more credible than someone like Jenny McCarthy. And I don't know why. It becomes popular. It just becomes like, maybe, I don't know. What is it? Is it that she's prettier than the scientists? I don't know.
Well, that's true. You know what, though? I got to tell you, I am a firm believer that the truth wins out in the end. It may not win immediately, but in the end, when things are sifted out, I think the facts come to the fore. I think it may be a rough road to get there, but you know, when I was a kid, one of the big scares that was present was that of polio. And I remember as a little boy seeing pictures of children in these gigantic iron lungs, and I was scared to death at the time. And there were all sorts of different, you know, rumors and stories about what polio was all about and who was likely to get it and how you could get it. And you know, I think this is just a manifestation of what's going on in our world today. But guess what? In the end, the truth about polio came out. It's now history. Nobody gives it a second thought anymore. So,
but it is what you were saying. One of you made the point that because vaccines work, nothing happens. So it's like, you know, we can't do a story saying there was no tornado in Atlanta today. You know, that it's just a fact. And so it is. It's a difficult thing to get at, but I think we all working together can tell these stories. HIV is gone. And we can pretty much tell that story. It's pretty recent, more recent than, say, some of the other ones. And so there's a way to do it. And I'm sorry, I'll shut up now. Go ahead.
I think it's not just Jenny McCarthy, frankly. It's the parents of any child sitting there saying, my child was injured. And the scientist with years and years and years of experience and knowledge getting a five-second soundbite and cut off usually in the middle and not in an appropriate way. And the audience is going to remember the child that was sitting there. And the scientist is not going to bring 500 children who weren't injured, who are happily playing in the background. And so the audience is left to see one injured child versus one scientist, or one scientist who's for and one scientist who's against, when in fact there are hundreds of scientists sitting behind that one scientist saying that vaccines are safe. And that part of the story never really becomes clear. It's this one parent and this one expert, or this expert and this other expert. So how, as people trying to get at the truth and educate about the truth, do you suggest that we make that point? How can we bring that story to the public? Because we don't want the controversy, but we're trying to educate about science, which is complex, and we're trying to do it in the way that we have to, which is through the media. And we can't explain complicated things in a soundbite.
Context. I think that it's really important to say, let me put this into context. Just say those words to the reporter. Let me put this into context. And you can say it to a TV reporter, too. You can say, yes, this doctor believes that, or published a paper that says such and such. That paper was later retracted. Mm-hmm. And you can say I thought the news media did a fairly decent job with this vaccine award recently, because the stories that I read, there was always a paragraph that said all major medical groups, and it would list them, the CDC, the IOM, the boom, 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 all believe, you know, all are have said that there is no relationship between vaccines and autism. So I think you just have to really keep pushing it to put it into context.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I do think it was that particular story was put into its proper context, and I must say that I thought the print media did a better job than television on that.
Well, thank you, folks, and if there are additional questions, I'm sure we'll be around for a few minutes to answer those questions. So thank you, Anita. Thank you, Mark.
And thank you.